The true mystery of the world is the visible, not the invisible. Oscar Wilde. On the 14th of April, 1956, early in the morning, a student, who should be me, makes his daily way from Rembrandtstraße over the Augarten Bridge to Schottenring and then up to the university. In the night, the Stock Exchange building burned down, was likely still burning, but the fire department had already accomplished the heroic phase of their mission. High up above the loggia, Neptune and his quadriga had not managed to escape the flames. The furious stallions, haunted by a panic-stricken fear of the fire, appeared petrified in a nightmarish scenario just before plunging down into the abyss of the Ringstrasse. Evidently, the god was subject to the laws of gravity, too. Now weak and pitiful, his heroic gesture transformed into a pose of helplessness. But what the devil was the almighty god of the sea doing up there on the Stock Exchange anyway? Had Theophil Hansen invited him instead of Mercury to crown his pompous architecture so as to epitomize the payful randomness of stock transactions? After all, long before his integration into the Roman pantheon, Neptune, still as Poseidon, threw dice with Zeus and Hades about the division of the world, with a well-known outcome. Some interpretations say that the big three cast lots. Howsoever, the reign of the sea and its trade routes fit well into the economic dreams of the now quite mercantile monarchy. The unbridled nature of the amorous rake Neptune, who, as the story goes, was not even afraid of Medusa and got her pregnant, albeit in the guise of a horse, obviously did not play an important role in his appointment to the post of the Stock Exchange god. Having said that, the erotic travail of the tired, along in the years Neptune with the Moses head, who presents himself in a strained beauty to astounded passers-by on Michaelerplatz, clearly seems to have left its traces. And the wall fountain Power at Sea, approximately on the site of the old Burgtheater, the taxed god is even found sitting down and seems more to just watch the dramatic tumult around him than control it. I must regretfully confess that for the longest time the student took little interest or even pleasure in the countless sculptures of the city, and just as little in the monuments. The so-called spiritual aspect of monuments weathers incredibly fast. In the shortest of time, they have lost their idea completely. Their contents have leaked out, said Alfred Polger. If the student would have known of Polger's thoughts at the time, like those of Karl Kraus about a monument to be built for Joseph Kainz, he would have endorsed them wholeheartedly. Decoration and ornament are aesthetic values, not religious, not philosophical, not political. So, did the Neptune fountain only serve as decor for Michaelerplatz or the Stock Exchange god, as an ornament for a building? Or are they rather embodiments of Austrian aspirations to world power at an inappropriate time, clad in antique disguise? Naturally, none of the spectators on Schottenring had any such thoughts on this 14th of April, 1956. The dying building was gawked at in the usual manner. The student, too, looked on thoughtlessly for quite some time and perhaps missed one or the other lecture or seminar. But now, with this fire disaster, it seemed to him as if the foreign city was demanding more attention and participation from the newcomer. Just 6 weeks ago, the student had come from Munich to Vienna, where he didn't know a soul. Upon his arrival, however, he had found lodging on Rembrandtstraße with the aid of a dubious middleman, which he only moved into because it was raining cats and dogs on this cold February day, and the sky had already grown dark. On the very next day, the student intended to find another room and confront the middleman, who instead of a single room had foisted him with half a twin room. When he entered, Franz Schubert was lying on the second bed. This was the name of the journeyman carpenter who rented the other half of the room. When the student finally awoke the next morning after the ordeal of the previous day, he was alone in the Schubert room, as the landlords called this room to his bewilderment. The apartment was empty. As it was raining again, and he had to take care of enrollment at the university, the student decided to postpone the house hunting to the next day. But it rained once again on the next day, and the day thereafter as well. The hesitant search did not bear a fitting success. And so, the student stayed tentatively in the house on Rembrandtstraße, and actually stayed 6 years in the end, having discovered that Franz Schubert was a pleasant fellow, and eventually a single room became free. On the whole, the old Bitstikas proved to be endearing and friendly people. Philemon and Bautzes from the Danube Canal is what we later called them, she a coffee lady at Praterstern, he an employee at the Anka Bakery. They tended to Franz Schubert and the student with great warm-heartedness. In the following autumn, there came a significant change to the student's customary paths. Now, he studied at the Max Reinhardt Seminar, meaning that he experienced the well-acquainted Schottenring primarily from the window of a streetcar and drove past the ruins of the fire, and without knowing it for a long time, also passed the largest and most famous scene of a fire on Schottenring and in Vienna without doubt. Diagonally opposite of the stock exchange gapped a vacant lot. It was flattened in 1945, following the bombardment of the so-called Sühnhof. It had been built on the site where the Ring Theater once stood, which opened in 1874 and burned to the ground on the 8th of December, 1881. More than 400 people went to their deaths. The recollection of the daily encounters with this vacant lot and therewith the tragic accident, incidentally, would remain in the memory of the student later on in his career. In 1959, he became an actor at the Burgtheater, later a director, and then the head of the house, and often had to painfully deal with extensive fire protection and safety regulations whose rigor could be traced back to the traumatic experiences of the municipal authorities responsible at the time of the Ring Theater fire. Some ministry officials in charge of compliance to these regulations, when in doubt, explicitly called upon this catastrophe, some so vehemently as if they had personally just escaped with the skin of their teeth on this 8th of December, 1881. Occasionally, trepidations around current threats reinforced the prevailing Ring Theater fire fear. For example, at the time of the RAF movement, I remember a dress rehearsal for Gorky's Summer Folk at the end of the 1970s. The uncompromising representative of the authorities demanded additional impregnation of a haystack on stage, even though there wasn't a fire, not a single candle foreseen in the production. And the unfortunate actors who came into contact with this now chemically contaminated haystack were already suffering from allergic reactions and watery eyes. Despite our protests, the guardians from the ministry flaunted their superiority with the ultimate question, "And what will you do when someone throws a Molotov cocktail onto the hay from the loge?" In response to the objection that potential Molotov cocktail throwers would more likely have an aggression toward the bourgeois theater audience than the hay, and such villains would probably prefer to toss their explosive surprise into the stalls, the unrelenting undersecretary replied, "I'm not responsible for the stalls." The anecdotal digression could mislead one to the small philosophical resume that major historical events more often end in fleeting short stories than unfading literature. In the case of the Ring Theater fire, with the modest exceptions of Schnitzler's novella Fritzi, Alles gerettet by Qualtinger and Merz, and the memories of the Ring Theater dramaturg and playwright Ludwig Ganghofer. Like major historical events, even important historical personalities are not immune to the descent into the lowlands of everyday triviality. In this context, neither the most imposing monument nor the most beautiful sculpture are of much help. The sculptors of the so-called Gründerzeit did not succeed for long in holding off the Greek and Roman gods on their way from Olympus to the operetta stages of this world and further on into the advertising industry. After they somehow had lost their elemental dominion over the cosmos, their brutality, their perfidy and insidiousness, their vindictiveness and bloodlust, their cannibalism, their impertinent vanities, and a number of their dark secrets over the course of the millennia, and were left with just their noble traits, some of these divine masteries absolved in this way made a stopover on the Ringstrasse in Vienna on their way through history to temporarily act as demure symbolic bureaucrats in the service of the Habsburg monarchy. And now, the mythical ladies and gentlemen sat and stood, floated and danced, throned and posed in a variety of likenesses as quotes of quotes before, upon and in the grandiose buildings of the 19th century, which in turn were quotes of quotes, links in a long chain of misunderstandings. At least all these petrified Viennese characters seemed that way to the student. When the student was still driving past the Burgtheater in a streetcar, he casually also mistook the Apollo high up on the balustrade for one of the Viennese, namely Emperor Joseph II, who graciously waved down at his subjects on the Ringstrasse. After all, his responsibility for the Burgtheater was far more evident than that of Apollo, as he had declared the Burgtheater the German National Theater on the 23rd of March, 1776, which commenced its illustrious history on the 8th of April with the performance of the piece Die Schwiegermutter by Franz Fuß, The Mother-in-Law by Franz Fuß. Even though the choice of this work, which is not attributable to the ranks of world literature, was not intended as a dramaturgical cornerstone for the new national theater, it must be pointed out that the so-called classics played a minor role quantitatively in the Burgtheater program for the longest time, not to mention the fact that the authors of antiquity were extremely rare guests in this building. In a 19th century so devoted to history, there was not a single new production of a Greek poet in the new house under the patronage of Apollo. Did the rapture for antiquity stop at the doors of the theater? Did an approaching classic hostile naturalism already cast its shadow? Or had the enthusiasm already dissipated due to an inadequate grip on reality? To this day, the normal visitors to the Burgtheater do not count the old Greeks among their classics and also do not call for them. The same goes for a somewhat oddly educated lady who joined the protests at the end of the 1970s against the apparently communist-leaning Burgtheater and the red bacilli swarming around there and concluded her indignant handwritten lines with the burning question, "Where have our classics gone?" The Burgtheater Apollo could have asked this question with all due right, because he not only had the seldom opportunity to represent his Greek clientele, but also landed all too often in the fatal predicament of greeting visitors streaming toward the house in the name of authors who had long since disappeared in the dark cellars of theater studies. So it is undeniable that poor Apollo on the Burgtheater with his lyre in hand, and despite the best efforts of the responsible muses and the wreaths of vibrant geniuses, stood for a long while fighting a losing battle as a messenger of antiquity. Perhaps he would have been better off on the state opera with all of its symbols of music, but there, oddly enough, the poet stallion Pegasus assumes the role of symbolic representation, not only once, but twice. Romantic and classic poetry, so they say, each rest upon a Pegasus on a pedestal, like a launch pad, so it seems, ready to fly off to Parnassus. Or perhaps they just landed? That would make more sense. Once the student had become an actor and got married, he lived in Vienna's third district, now circled the ring in the other direction, wondered a bit about the winged horses on the opera, and exited the streetcar at the Burgtheater. There began a halcyon days of the household Apollo, for an antiquity cycle was to be performed. The young actor was granted a role in Oedipus the King, Antigone, and Electra, and enjoyed the wonderful privilege of coming to know Fritz Wottruber, the stage and costume designer of these pieces. I well recall a dress rehearsal for Orestes. Wottruber was again speaking passionately, and on this particular day in the Hanushof rehearsal room, quite extensively about the veracity and unfathomable power of the archaic world in contrast to all of the classic crap, especially in Vienna. Specifically, he meant classicism and other misunderstandings of the Greek classics. Like Heracles, Wottruber shattered this chain of misunderstandings. That thoroughly impressed the young actor, but also battered his former veneration of Winckelmann, which admittedly was more of a local patriotic solidarity. The student had spent his childhood in Stendhal, and Winckelmann was pretty much the only famous son of this town, and the young actor would have preferred that this local idol remained unscathed abroad, but after the Wottruber sessions, there was nothing more to be reaped from the noble simplicity and silent heroes, and nothing whatsoever from the, for the most part, Roman stepchildren of Winckelmann antiquity in the streets and on the roofs of Vienna. This, however, did not disturb the young actor at all, as the borrowed gods were still foreign to him, and their role as pagan or atheist state symbols, such as the Athena statue in front of the Parliament, in such a Catholic land, was still a mystery to him. In contrast, Wottruber's contagious allergy against the classic had an almost liberating effect, especially on the young Burgtheater actor. By the way, this dress rehearsal went on unusually long because Wottruber had to make fundamental changes to his original costume concept. Leg and arm braces permitted no normal forms of movement, no uninhibited walking in his stage design. To this end, Wottruber sacrificed, to some degree reluctantly, his sculptural convictions to pragmatic stage requirements and cursed, "It's a damn shame you have to move." That was his explicit art theoretical statement on the statics of movement, which froze all of the racing quadrigas on the spot, but did not answer the question of the naive observer, why and where do they actually want to go? A couple of years later, when the Burgtheater made a guest performance of Oedipus the King in Athens, the young actor could not ward off the suspicion, given how totally out of place Wottruber's decoration was in the Odeon of Herodes Atticus, that the revered Viennese Heracles had not really shattered the chain of misunderstandings after all. That was an important lesson, one of many over the course of the years, which taught him to see through the usual know-it-all arrogance of the respective here and now, toward all past manifestations, and to conceive most of the so-called misunderstandings as temporary insights, including those of the 19th century with its seemingly orientationless eclecticism. Hermann Bahr's uncompromising revelation of the blasphemous modernism of an epoch that in the past viewed all art as just a vast quarry of motives coincided quite well with the perception of the student, but gradually it lost its attractivity in favor of Bahr's complementary thinking about the Ringstrasse culture, namely that powerlessness was never displayed in such an enchanting grace, boldness, and dignity, that triviality never spoke in such stunning eloquence. And the young actor, who had once studied history, also learned to increasingly question the role of historiography as the last resort, to understand it as a worldview of professed temporality, and to recognize in art and, above all, in literature, the true, reliable, unadulterated documents and records of a respective time. In this way, the relation of the half-foreign Viennese from Magdeburg to the Ringstrasse and its borrowed gods gradually changed. Knowledge about the city, also dispensable knowledge, had indeed accumulated over the years, but this greater knowledge was time and again unsettled by the goddess Fama, the wholly Viennized and most influential among the borrowed goddesses, whose power is undiminished to this day and was caught floating over the city in corpora. The befeathered mythical lady, a horrid creature according to Virgil, the messenger of truth and lies according to Ovid, responsible for gossip, rumors, and slander, but also for the fame of her clientele, ironically took abode upon the Hofburg Palace and certain other monuments. With her contradictory competences, she could actually serve well as the patron saint of journalism as well. Soon, and long before departure as the director of a theater which was always different than its reputation ever since its opening with Die Schwiegermutter, The Mother-in-Law by Franz Fuchs, in a country that always thought differently than it acted, it became clear to him that also theater historians almost unanimously paid court to Fama and stood in line behind the journalists. Not only did the expiry dates of their temporary insights come one after the other in increasingly shorter intervals, but also the investigation of artistic reality was ousted by the history of artistic marketing and media attention. Hence, journalistic tussles about the allegedly worth mentioning had the strongest results. Floating islands of arbitrariness were proclaimed the mainland of art. The loudest windmakers were assigned an aura of artistic vigor, and their wind confused with theater sensations. In this spirit, the divine windmaker Boreas on top of the roof of the Burgtheater perhaps symbolically blows the old air from the theater out into the world. And perhaps Apollo is enthroned up there because he was born on a floating island. A banal representation like the one in the Wiener Allgemeine Zeitung daily paper from the year 1888, however, destroyed such interpretative audacity. There one could read, "The odd-shaped bronze figure is the mechanism that prevents the entry of wind into the exhaust vent. We see the aesthetic solution in the form of Boreas blowing into a conch." What an undignified job for a god who saved the Athenians from the Persians, founded the Eleusinian mysteries, and in the semblance of a dark man stallion, mounted 12 mares of the Trojan king Erichthonius, and now had to help ventilate a theater? What a demise! But if you were to climb toward the god of wind up there and take a closer look, he would show no symptoms of debasement, just high spirits and a compelling exuberance. He seems to enjoy his job. The sight is an exemplary confirmation of the old temporary insight that the twilight of the gods had a merry character in the 19th century, that the lunatic old stories of the Theogony, quite detrimental to a perfect world, had been kept under lock and key, and the chroniclers of the old gods, Homer and Hesiod, Virgil and Ovid, were ushered into the obscurity of a distant antiquity. In tried and true Austrian fashion, the borrowed gods indeed presented the good sides of their chaotic pasts in keeping with the rules of courtesy, so that really nothing more stood in the way of their pragmatization as symbolic bureaucrats of the monarchy. However, the notorious Boreas, despite his historical accomplishments, was without doubt assigned a rather menial task. There's no getting around this conclusion, even when one symbolically polishes up his function on the Burgtheater roof and valorizes the artistic importance. When today an older man, who would be me, circles the Ringstrasse once again in the streetcar or walks by on foot, past the old friends in front of the buildings and on the roofs, then inevitably the past returns to the present without all the sentimental to-do, simply as a part of life. I think of people who truly impressed me once but are no longer here. At the Hotel am Parkring, I remember exhausting conversations and long, inebriated evenings with Oscar Werner, and think of the friendly discussions in Café Imperial with Canetti or Dürrenmatt, and of the last birthday party of Adrienne Gessner in her apartment on the other side of the ring, right across the street, or of my first visit to Alma Seidler, a couple of houses further in the direction of the opera, to speak with her about the nurse in my production of Strindberg's The Father. A few years later, I had to hold my first eulogy for her before escorting her coffin around the Burgtheater, and Apollo waved her a final salute. At the opera intersection, the demonstration against Borodajkiewicz in 1965 comes to mind. It escalated, and behind the opera house, a man was killed. I think of my first stroll together with Mannes Sperber on the short way from the Burgtheater to the Batzenhäusel across from the university, which took much longer because Sperber kept stopping temperamentally in order not to walk over important parts of his speech or our conversation. He picked up his friend, the actor Manfred Inger, and me at the stage door following a performance of Egmont, which he was not overly pleased with. That was 1962, and it was the beginning of a friendship that lasted until his death in 1985. And then, underway on Schottenring, past the resurrected stock exchange and my old comrade Neptune, the entanglement of memories elicits thoughts about the numerous walks with Rupi Weiss, who lived on Gonzaga Gasse and was more intelligent and well-read than any other. That was during my student years when I still lived on Rembrandtstrasse. We often walked each other home in the evening, back and forth, and there was always still so much to talk about. The forgotten Rupi Weiss, who became a remarkable dramaturg and was the mentor of Václav Havel in the Burgtheater, was the son of the forgotten Rudolf Weiss, who was an outstanding cabaretist and author. But this is no place for mnemosyne. And on the Danube Canal, at the end of the path around the ring, there where it began each day in 1956, I remember the old Betstikas and envision a splendid monument for them.